We're back. Welcome to No Direction, the Pathfinder News, Reviews, and Interviews podcast. I'm your host, Jefferson J. Thacker, also known as Parham, and I'm joined for this very special interview with Chris Sims, formerly of Paizo and Wizards of the Coast. Hey, Chris.
Hey, how's it going?
It's doing good. Now, Chris, for those who may not be familiar with you and your work, could you please tell us a little bit about your background in game design?
Where should I start?
Usually the first publication or your first passion of awesomeness?
Well, I started working for Wizards of the Coast in 2003. And I started as a freelance editor, and then I started working on card editing for Wizards of the Coast in 2005. That's when I actually moved to the Seattle area. And then since then, I've worked for Wizards of the Coast and Paizo and many other companies, depending on what I was doing as a full-time job at the moment, because at certain points I couldn't work for others because Wizards doesn't let you compete, for example. And I think at Paizo you had to get special permission too, but they were a little bit more willing to let that happen. So, but I've worked on a bunch of different stuff for since 2003.
That's interesting. You said you started editing for the cards first. How is editing for a card game different from editing for an RPG?
Well, I was editing for the RPG as a freelancer, but they hired me to replace a lady who was going on hiatus for the card side at Wizards of the Coast. And then after probably 6 months, a little bit more than that there, I moved to RPGs inside Wizards. But I think that editing for cards is great because it forces you to trim the mechanics to the smallest possible footprint. It teaches you how to say something in the fewest possible words, which can be good for mechanics because in my opinion, a mechanic can be made unclear by extraneous words. So,
do you think if using that skill set to its extreme, you could cut the core rulebook down to 100 pages?
Probably not. Probably not. I mean, the rules for Pathfinder, for example, are so dense, and a lot of them, I don't think that you could change too much, but it's been most things that I edit get shorter, though. I will say that.
Now, one of the reasons that we have brought you on to the show is a year old post has sort of resurfaced into the zeitgeist as we begin talking about, you know, maybe it's not such a great idea that we have our fantasy settings that paint entire sentient species as evil. And yeah, you had a wonderful post on this topic that sort of helped reframe the rules. And as much as I like to avoid Godwin when possible, you managed to do so by using Nazis.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the reason I use Nazis is because almost everybody agrees that Nazis are bad. So, and kind of those people who don't agree that Nazis are bad probably are the Nazis. So, you know, so you get something that everybody can kind of agree on, and then it makes a really good tool for bringing what seems like disparate viewpoints together. So,
I mean, there was a time in the 90s where just about every video game villain was just some flavor of Nazis. These are Nazis in the castle. These are space Nazis on the moon.
Yeah. No. I mean, and Iron Sky. I mean, everything from Wolfenstein to Iron Sky. It's like, yeah, Nazis are a great villain. So.
So how can we use, you've got presented a set of rules here, but just a general overview, how can we use our understanding that Nazis equals bad to understanding why orcs not always bad?
Well, the way I'd put it is that you can treat imaginary people as more complex than cardboard villains, and everybody understands that Nazi does not equal all of humanity. So, that's the frame of reference. And I think that it's better for play and for design if we consider imaginary people as more complex than their worst element. So even if their worst element is the leadership, right? I mean, in Nazi Germany, the leadership was the bad element. That didn't make all Germans and Austrians Nazis by any stretch of the imagination.
So I want to run down your list here, rule by rule. I present the rule and then you explain it and help us understand how this can help reframe and make our role-playing games a more rich experience when we play them. Your very first rule is the one we just talked about. Nazis right. don't make all humans bad. And I think most of us agree that not all humans are bad.
Yeah, right. And even when the primary examples of a society are bad, this is common in Wizards of the Coast Drow, for example. That doesn't mean and shouldn't mean that the entire species is inherently evil. That's kind of a weird thing that when you put it in the context of Nazis don't make all humans bad, it becomes pretty clear. Whereas somebody might say, well, you know, Drow are influenced by an evil god and blah, 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 blah. But, you know, we also have examples from human history where certain societies worshipped a god that might be characterized as not a benevolent entity, you know, and that didn't make everybody who was a participant in that society evil.
All right. Now, your second rule is it's okay to punch Nazis.
Right.
How does that help us here? Because I agree.
Well, how it helps us is that in the context of role-playing games is that you can frame certain individuals that are members of a species as bad guys, right? These guys are elf Nazis. These guys are goblin bandits. These guys are bugbear assassins. And if you're playing heroic characters in a high fantasy, heroic fantasy genre, then it's your job to stop those people, right? And sometimes to stop them, you're going to have to punch them or, you know, drop a fireball on them or whatever. And, they're the bad guys. That doesn't mean that every bugbear has to be bad. It just means that those guys, those particular guys that we're facing right now, they are the bad guys. And it's okay to drop the hammer on them, especially in the context of a game that is just, that focuses on heroes smiting monsters. I mean,
and this isn't even in this context, this isn't even a new idea, even in classical fantasy or some of our more popular fantasy settings. You mentioned the Drow situation, but if you take a look at, say, the Old World Warhammer setting, the dark mm-hmm. elves in that setting literally are just high elves that are evil, that have a completely different view. They're not physically different. They picked a side and that side was evil.
Yeah. And in that context, I would say that not all of those dark elves and not all members of that society are evil though, but, mm-hmm. but the ones that are involved, even the ones that are involved in the conflict might not necessarily be evil, but they have chosen a side.
And why is it important that it's okay to punch Nazis? Is this about making sure that we present have available to us people to conflict against that the players won't hesitate or won't resist conflict with?
It is about that, but it's also a lot of people say, well, if you say that orcs aren't evil, then every time you face an orc in combat, it's a moral quandary. Well, in one of the later rules, I do address that idea in a deeper fashion. But the truth is that when, you know, the goblin bandits stop you on the road and they're going to murder you if you don't acquiesce to their demands, and steel gets drawn, worrying about your opponent as a moral being kind of falls by the wayside when your survival's on the line, for example. Or in the context of greater heroics, when a villain is threatening the existence of an entire society or whatever, debating with yourself philosophically whether this person has some inherent goodness in them might not be the best thing to do when they're dropping cloud kill on you. That's kind of the point.
Now, your next rule is it's not okay to punch Nazi kids.
Right. Well, this is kind of the context of not all members of the evil psych.
Oh, hold on. We lost your audio there for a second, Chris.
Okay.
Hey, you appear to be back.
Okay. So the point of it's not okay to punch Nazi kids is that not – so that's a subset of the point that even if you have evil leadership or an evil group or an evil organization, not all members of that body are evil, first of all. And second of all, if you're talking about something like kids and things like that, they are – if you're talking about a sapient species, they're not even indoctrinated. Even if they're living with the bad guys, they're still not indoctrinated necessarily, and they're also not responsible for the evil that their elders have done. So it's just not okay to hold the innocent accountable for it's guilt by association, right? It's punishing guilt by association, and that's in my opinion, that's immoral.
Yeah, and we've as a society, we've long since accepted that children are just not capable of making informed consent choices of that scale.
Right. So, one of the things that I point out in this rule is that if you don't want the moral quandary of the bad guys having kids in their camp, if the evil people having kids in their camp, don't put kids in their camp. I mean, we have, as people who run and make games, we have complete control over what's in these encounters. So right. If we have a society, if we say goblins are a species and goblins have children, and then this group of goblins is bad guys, and you don't want your players to have to decide what to do with goblin kids, don't put goblin kids in the goblin warren, right?
So, yeah, you actually, Paizo actually presented this exact moral quandary in the very first issue of Pathfinder, and actually sidestepped it, because when you get to the goblin camp in Pathfinder 1, in Rise of Renlord's Burnt Offerings, it's like the goblins have been so busy that the goblin kids have eaten each other. There are no goblin kids in here. And then it presents a sidebar that's like, if you want the moral quandary of having goblin kids, you can put them back in here and they haven't eaten each other. But like, it looks like you, at least Paizo, at least has been walking the walk as well as talking the talk on this topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that giving somebody who's running a game the power to make an informed design choice about how it's going to run at their table is a good way to go, because you can just put it in the context of there were teenagers and young kids that were being indoctrinated by the Nazis and doing work for the Nazis. But the thing is that I still feel like punishing them is punishing guilt by association more. I think that their elders are responsible for abusing them more than they are responsible for evil is the easiest way to put it, I guess.
Your next rule, number 4, is some Nazis went to prison. How does this apply here?
Well, I think that often we allow our swords to do our talking for us in role-playing games a little too much, to quote Christopher Marlowe, but it's not always necessary to kill the villain. There are other punishments. There are alternatives. I mean, in role-playing games, especially like high fantasy hero role-playing games, killing the monster is usually the thing that happens. But we, going back to having control over how we design our games, how we and how we play them, and how we present them at the table, it's always an option to capture somebody. It's always an option to mete out some other punishment after you've defeated them or captured them or what have you. I mean, so a lot of times the scenario doesn't even necessarily call for the villain to be killed, just calls for the villain to be stopped, right? So the villain is doing something nefarious, poisoning the city's water supply or whatever. The important part of the equation is stopping the villain from poisoning the water supply. It isn't beating the villain to a pulp or killing the villain. In fact, bringing the villain to justice could help the society more than killing the villain, because if the villain just disappears and nobody knows what happened to them, then the story ends there. But if society can be presented with, this is the guy who was doing all this stuff to us, and he's going to be brought to justice.
And that's a very good point. And it's also a very good point to GMs that may have cringed at that to know that you need to build your stories to be able to survive one of the henchmen being taken prisoner, because if your story breaks, if everyone doesn't die instantly after the end of combat, it needed work.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. And also, I think that the decision to show mercy is a heroic trait. So players should be allowed to express that type of heroism in addition to the bravery of facing, you know, these death-defying situations and defeating these monsters and villains. So
I've also noticed, this is getting a little bit meta and outside the point here, but I call upon you for your wise wisdom and experience to help other GMs get around this. Enough of my players that I play with have been burned enough in the past that the concept of letting anyone live or run away, they have been punished for these decisions. How do you get past this past biases and make it obvious that mercy is indeed an option when a lot of players have been taught that mercy is how you get stabbed in the back?
Well, I mean, one way is to present story reasons why a character who might tend towards merciful behavior would go that direction. Like, you know, good villains have reasons for what they're doing. They're not just maniacal, murderous thugs. Not that there's anything wrong with the occasional maniacal, murderous thug in a game, but the compelling villains have reasons for what they do, and often those reasons can raise the sympathies of the players and their characters, depending on the personality of the character and the personality of the player. So, but I don't know how you can undo somebody who has been repeatedly betrayed by their game master always punishing them for letting someone live. I think the best way to do that as a game master is to not always do that, to make mercy pay off sometimes. So when the heroes show mercy, there is some backside benefit down the road. It could even be as big as the villain showing up to help in some other situation on the right side this time, you know, bringing their power to bear in a fashion that actually helps the characters. So I think that all of that stuff, first of all, it occurs in genre fiction, you know, and second of all, it makes a more compelling story. And it also, it adds to tension at the same time, because there are going to be players who are like, oh God, this guy is on the battlefield with us. Can we trust him? Is he going to turn on us? Is he going to betray us? Especially those people who have been burned over and over again are going to go, I don't know if we want this guy fighting alongside of us, you know? So I'm not necessarily saying that we should, in the context of Nazis, that Nazis should be allowed to join the good side at the end, but I don't know. Anyway, it's
your next role might apply here. It's Germans were liberated from the Nazis too rule.
Right. So that's kind of the same thing as not all the people are bad, right? So the people who are ruled by the Nazis, some percentage of them didn't sympathize with the Nazi rule. They went along with it because they had two choices: allow the Nazis to do what they're going to do, or go to prison and be killed, you know, that type of thing. So, and a lot of normal people, if you give them the choice to be oppressed or die, they're going to live and be oppressed, unfortunately, you know, or fortunately, I mean, you know, thank goodness a lot of us don't have to deal with that type of thing, but, in real life. But, the point is that when you get rid of an evil, often you're freeing people, you're freeing the innocent and the powerless from that evil, even if those innocent and powerless people were part of the society in question. Like, for example, if you went into Menzo Baranzan in the Forgotten Realms and you removed the theocracy, there's got to be a large number of drow in that city that would be thankful that theocracy was gone.
Next up is, I think this ties into that the last rule fairly tightly, which is humans are more complex than their Nazis.
Yeah, I mean, it's also kind of a reiteration of not, you know, your worst elements in your society don't define you as a species. Mm-hmm. you understand what I'm saying? So even people who joined the Nazi regime were not there were layers of complexity. They still chose evil. I mean, this is what we were talking about when we were talking about the elves in Warhammer. They still chose a side, right? They still chose the bad side. They chose to be the baddies. And the thing is that the complexity issue is one of making interesting imaginary people, right? It allows for more interesting stories, for people to just be more complex than my species is lawful evil, right? So it might allow you to find a sympathizer on the inside in a game or a piece of fiction. It allows you to tell stories of liberation and stories that defy expectations. It also allows you to tell kind of flip the expectation on its head. So there are plenty of people, and this has been exemplified by the way some of the older generation in role-playing games has depicted the way this works. And that is that, so if somebody's supposedly good and they just paint with a broad stroke that this entire species is malevolent and therefore should be put to the sword, I would question their goodness.
Right. I mean, that's a classical fictional archetype for a character that eventually does become, or very quickly becomes, an antagonist that doesn't have to be a Nazi, is you enjoy this work a little too much.
Right. I think the Punisher, for example, in the Marvel Universe falls into this category of somebody who people make the mistake that he's a good guy. He's not. He's painted an entire category of people who could fall into the bad guy category as people worthy only of a bullet.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not goodness.
Right. I mean, Punisher, even the creator, is like, it's supposed to be a warning, not to be exemplified.
Right, exactly. So I think a lot of people who are powerless, they mistake strength and the ability to do violence as justice, but it's not. Real justice is having that power and using it gently and wisely.
Now, you mentioned a rule here that isn't actually one of your numbered rules, but I thought it was incredibly important, is that you mentioned when steel clears leather.
Yeah. When steel. Yeah.
Explain this. It wasn't one of your numbered rules, but I kind of lost track of where it was in the post. So could you explain why steel clears leather is an important thing to consider here?
Oh yeah. Well, that goes back to the point of when you're under immediate threat, when your life is under immediate threat and you're facing a bunch of even sapient creatures who intend to see you dead, considering their moral character is probably not number one on your priority list. Surviving the encounter is what's number one on your priority list. And if that means that the violence has to escalate to death, then especially in the typical genre fiction or role-playing game, that's what's going to happen. I mean, you know, if you're facing orc marauders raiding the village and they're just killing people left and right, even if your campaign setting doesn't say that all orcs are evil, you know what the context is what matters here. You have a bunch of raiders. Even if they were human, you have a bunch of raiders that are just burning down houses, killing people, stealing things, and they're going to kill you. So you're not just going to stand there when you can draw your sword and defend yourself, and you're not going to consider whether or not you should kill these guys. You're going to consider surviving and stopping them from what they're doing. And that's the point.
And the reason I brought this up now was it's also a important thing to consider when your foe isn't the Nazis, when we are dealing with a Punisher situation, when, you know, technically, when two groups are maybe should be on the same side, doesn't mean that they are allowed to just get away with wrongness. And like when still there's leather, when the swords are drawn, that's when the moral quandary needs to be put aside for a minute, because things are much more, there's some much more immediate threat in the air.
Right, exactly. And the point is that even if you're facing somebody that would normally be your ally, when when swords are drawn, you know, maybe you say, okay, well, we're going to do our best to subdue these people. And because we know that there has to be a mistake somewhere. We should be on the same side or something. But that's probably going to be the limit of it until the combat is over. And then, you know,
more moralizing to be done. We talk about genre fiction. Systems like Pathfinder in D&D actually make non-lethal options a little bit easier to pull off than a lot of classic fantasy would present that option. Like, it's almost leans more into like the superhero comic side of things, where I'm pretty sure most of the people that get hit with Cyclops laser beam should be dead.
Right, exactly.
And yes, before the comment scream, I know it's concussive force and it's not actually a laser beam, but I like saying laser beam. Whereas in most fantasy fiction, like, it almost seems like the daggers lunge themselves into hearts.
Right. Yeah. I mean, all right. I don't know Pathfinder's 2's option by heart, but I know that, you know, and in Pathfinder 1 and 3.5 D&D, it was a little harder because you had to say you were dealing non-lethal damage before you attacked because it affected your attack roll and stuff like that. But in 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons, for example, you can just hit somebody. And if the DM says, okay, well, that's it, you could say, okay, well, I want to knock them out instead of killing them. You could say it right then, right?
And BF2 is the same way. It's the last hit is what decides it. And mm-hmm. And with spells, you kind of have to do something special. You have to cast that one with the merciful toggle on. But for physical attacks, I think you just get to choose.
Yeah, and I think that's okay because you kind of want the player to be able to decide. And that goes back to something that you said about making sure that it's okay if your villains do survive, right? Make sure that your venture still works if some of your villains do survive, because especially in a game where the player can just choose to say, okay, he's knocked out. Okay, now we're going to wake him up and question him. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what happens next in those situations often. So,
and this is why I keep my name card next to my GM screen, because inevitably they're going to ask their name and I'm not going to have it. And next rule. Anyway, we still got Nazis. Getting back to Nazis. We still got them. What's this mean? Rule 7.
We still have plenty of villains. I mean, even if you make every imaginary person in your campaign setting or every imaginary society in your campaign setting a very complex one with moral nuances, even if the top echelon is, you know, demon-worshipping diabolists, you still, even in good societies, you still have the element that can be villainous, right? I mean, you have people who are raiders or bandits or, apocalypse cultists or, you know, just people who are cruel and murderous. I mean, so you don't have to characterize an entire species as evil to have villains in your game. You don't have to characterize an entire species as evil to have villains in your fiction. So there are plenty of villains in the real world, and not all humans are evil.
Like, so you don't have to say all, we keep going back to orcs because it's the easy one to go to, but you don't have to say all orcs are irredeemably evil to say Gogthrog's Skull Taker is irredeemably evil.
And you don't even have to say Gogthrog Skull Taker is irredeemably evil. He's just evil. He will gut you and drink your blood. I mean, without thinking about it. And he will do that to your sister too, and your brother, and your cousins. And he won't stop unless somebody stops him. He's a bad guy.
So even though we make our, like, this is happening a lot, and I don't know if you've had any involvement in the production of Lost Omens: Wongi Expanse, but that's a book that just dropped and has and does a really good job of portraying the different ancestries throughout Mwangi in multitudes of shades of motivations and cultures and I'm avoiding saying the phrase alignment, but like the complex well-developed whole cultures. And yeah, you do have like the ones that lean towards evil, like the Shirakas, who used to serve the demon worshiping baddies and stuff like that, and some who still very much do. And you have whole regions where we have problems. There's a lot of demons in the Mwangi Expanse. It's like,
yeah,
it's like very high. It's like cloudy with a high chance of demon is a common weather forecast there.
Yeah, it gives a new meaning to acid rain, right?
Yeah, and so it like in the and the and particularly the orcs that they portray in Mwangi, where they have this nine layered city and they're humongous demon fighters, and so it's a complete kind of reversal for what we consider orcs, and like the fact that they have this most central city, they have these pompous like spoiled to death orcs that they're proud of, because the other orcs like, we kept them so safe that they could get this soft and pompous.
Yeah,
that's great. And so you have this complex society, but that doesn't mean that the orcs that you're going to fight in next week's adventure are any less evil, any less ruthless, any less terrible, if that's the role they need to play in that story.
Right. I mean, when we make villains in our stories, we and our adventures for role playing games, they're villains. I mean, unless they're villains, even if their alignment isn't evil, right? Mm-hmm. There's some conflict there, and that kind of takes us to the next rule, I think, which is we have more problems than Nazis, or something like that.
Oh yeah, Nazis aren't the only problem, which is rule sunglasses.
Yeah, it's rule 8. For some reason, it changed it to sunglasses on Facebook, I think. So I can't take any credit for the greatness that is the Mwangi Expanse book. So just to clear that up. But there are plenty of conflicts that don't involve evil, right? There are plenty of conflicts that do. And there are, from the predatory monster that you have to stop from eating people, to two groups having a theocratic disagreement, you know, one accusing the other of heresy. You know, this is not, neither side can be characterized as evil in a lot of these cases. And I think that makes for more interesting storytelling, really, because it isn't just cut and dry. And often it's not something that a sword or a fireball can solve. So,
Not to poke fun too much at Paizo, but y'all have had, I know you're not with Paizo now, but Paizo has had a little bit of a joking reputation of presenting very complex backgrounds to villains that will exist for 3 combat rounds. And no one will ever know that complex background. Like I point to the Mithril Mage in Rise of the Runelords, the callback to one that many people might be necessary. Very complex background about his rivalry and how he got his brain turned to Mithril, and so he can't develop new memories. And that's like 4 fireballs and a couple of combat rounds and some stabbing, and my players never understood what in the world he was doing. But like, well, I'm saying, like villains have backgrounds, villains have complex motivations, and it's helpful to know them.
And it's helpful for the players to have a method to learn them. It's helpful for the adventure to convey that to the player somehow. Like, imagine reading a novel and having that experience. Like, you know, the heroes bust in on this guy. They know that he's doing something bad, but the novel has never explained why, how, who this person is. You as a reader would be like, what's happening? Why do I care about this? Like, you know, so... I think that as a developer, one of my jobs is to make sure that some of that information comes through to players, if not all of it. It's really important for players to understand that this person, this villain that we're facing, this is why he's doing what he's doing, or she's doing what she's doing, or whatever. So, yeah.
And that leads into rule number 9. Nazis are people.
Yeah, I mean...
This swings both ways.
Right, right, right. So the point is that I think it's my opinion that truly righteous people, truly heroic people, do consider their enemies humanity. But considering that while you're fighting to try to stop this person you know, we keep going back to this point. It's not your first instinct, right? It's not your first. It's not your first priority. It's not going to be your first priority. Your first priority is probably surviving, and your second priority is to stop the bad guy from doing what they're doing. If they happen to die in that combat, then, you know, in a lot of heroic fantasies, that's acceptable, right? I mean, but I think on the other side of that, when if you get to the other side of that where you've won, and but you haven't killed your foe, considering that person's personhood is valid, and in my opinion, an aspect of goodness. It's an aspect of being heroic.
I've always viewed the talking point that Nazis are people, not so like one of the aspects I like to focus on that one when discussing it is not so much as a way to lessen the evil of the Nazi, but as more of a warning. It's just like yeah, they're people, and people do terrible things, and people are capable of horrible things, and you don't need to inject like. And they were all corrupted by demon blood and horrible stuff to justify why people could be absolutely horrible.
Yeah, that's true too. And and that's what you meant by it swings both ways, right? I mean, it's
right.
So I think that a hero can be merciful, consider the other person's personhood, and all of that stuff. But it's also exactly like you said that. You don't have to resort to some supernatural corruption, like you said, to say that this person is bad. You don't have to paint the entire. You certainly don't have to paint the entire species as corrupt and evil to say that this person is bad.
Mm-hmm. And that brings us to the final rule, which is being better than a Nazi doesn't make you righteous.
Right. So. When you have a lot of power, as a lot of the heroic characters in these stories and in these games do, you get to a point where you can kind of do whatever you want within a certain power scale, right? So normal people can't touch you, right? And stuff like that. So, and the truly heroic consider the ramifications of their actions in that context. People who don't are the people who end up being the bad guys. Right. So even if their intentions were good at the beginning, if they say my power gives me the right to dictate the path of my entire society, that is leaning into something that's not so good. Right. Just going around smiting everything can start to look a lot like evil. Like it can start to look a lot like you're the bad guy. It can start to look a lot like you're the problem, right? Because if you go around and just kill everything, your go-to solution is we're just going to kill all the monsters and let the consequences fall where they may after the fact. That doesn't seem like heroic behavior to me. The Witcher is a good example of this, where a lot of the stories hinge on Geralt finding out what's really going on, mm-hmm. right? And instead of just killing the monster, which he could do, he definitely could just do that. He discovers that there's a very complicated curse, and he puts himself at great personal risk to undo that curse, rather than just killing the monster, rather than just drawing a silver sword and putting the monster to it. And which is a much more interesting story, really.
And the novels do a great job of portraying that, and I don't know if you've played a lot of the games.
I played all the way through Witcher 3, right. And stuff like that. So I've read several of the novels. So
Witcher 3 especially, and I'm sure the others do as too. But there are several points where it teaches you that the easy solution is not the right solution. Over right. and over again, it's like, oh right. crap, I feel terrible about myself now because I did the easy thing and later found out, no, horrible, terrible ghost is evil, is even more evil. And of course the evil ghost lied to me.
Yes, of course the evil ghost lied to you. But The Witcher also presents situations where nobody that Geralt is trying to help is the good guy, mm-hmm. too, which is also an interesting story. Like, and I wouldn't do this too much in a role-playing game because it's a feel-bad moment for players. I think it's okay. It's better in fiction and maybe movies and even video games. But every once in a while in a role-playing game, though, I think it's okay for the players to discover that there is the only way to win this game, this particular scenario, is not to play. Like, to say, we're not going to help you, and we're not going to help you. Bye-bye. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I imagine most people that have played Witcher 3 have gone through Bloody Baron, and that's just a giant feel-bad moment throughout that entire quest line.
Although, I think that the Bloody Baron storyline in Witcher 3 has some redeeming moments, at least for Geralt.
Right.
You know, Geralt can do the right thing, even though nobody else in that scenario has. Right. Where there's another scenario in The Witcher 3 where this town is being terrorized by Leshy, a very ancient Leshy, and the priest that lives in the town wants to propitiate the Leshy. And there's another faction in the town that just wants to get rid of the Leshy. And so you listen to both sides and you go in the forest to find this Leshy, and whatever you do. But when you come back, well, actually, whatever you decide, when you come back, the people who didn't like the priest and his solution have murdered him.
Ouch.
And it doesn't matter what you did to face the monster. They have taken matters into their own hands and decided that this traditionalist that wants to have them deal with the monster over and over again, he's got to go. And in my opinion, in that particular scenario, the best thing you can do is just walk away, because if you try to confront them about what they did, it turns into a brawl, and a brawl with Geralt is not going to end well for anybody besides Geralt. So,
and one of the other things I wanted to, this is a quote on a Twitter quote I saw running around. I don't know if this needs to be attributed higher. I've tried to do some research in advance of this episode for that. But from Ian McIntyre, who is a writer, you mentioned that just because you have power doesn't mean you're righteous. He says, Superman stories aren't a fantasy about how good it would be to have power, but it's a fantasy about what it would be like if someone with power was good.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly the point, right? So one of the most difficult things in some of these games is to try to play a character who is actually good, because often the easy solution is, this town says they have problems with goblins, we'll just go root the goblins out of the cave nearby and call it a day. You know, a much more interesting story would be to go to the goblins and find out that the mayor of the town made a deal with them and broke that deal. And so the problems that are being, they decided that they're going to raid the village because, and then you also find out, well, they haven't really hurt anybody. They've just been stealing cattle or sheep or whatever, you know? So, I mean, you can have interesting stories that don't require you to kill sapient creatures.
And in many a role-playing game group I've been in, there comes a point when the players have gained significant amounts of power and then are challenged by the town. Don't do this, don't do that. And then they have to come to that, like, the easy solution here is to abuse our power and do what we want anyway. And that is definitely not always the good solution.
Yeah. And often there's somebody that will come try to take care of you if you end up being the bad guy. So, I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, once, you know, the power corrupts, well, is your character going to be a proof of that axiom or an exception to it?
And Chris, that brings us to the end of your Nazi rules. What do you hope that the community, the role players, learn going forward a year later from when you wrote these? Now that the discourse has again returned to the complexities of the peoples in their stories.
Well, one of the reasons I wrote this entry is because I figured that I saw a lot of people kind of talking past each other. You know, mm-hmm. and I felt like, well, let's find a way to see if I can distill this into something that a lot of people would just agree with, right? And, you know, I even had people come to me after I wrote this post and say, you know, I was on the other side of this argument from you, and after reading this post, I've flipped, you know. And, but another thing that I, want people to think about is it's not just the moral implications or the heroic implications of the use of power or the use of violence, but also the fact that having complex imaginary people in imaginary societies is actually better for storytelling. So at its simplest, having a cardboard villain is just that, right? You know, having this entire species, they might as well be robots if they're just, you can just fight them and it's not important, right?
That sounds like a Saturday morning solution.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, so that was the other point, was that I think that complex imaginary people are better for storytelling, they're better for play, and they're better for what we learn from playing.
All right. So, Chris, you have turned freelance. How is the freelance life?
It's pretty good. One of the reasons it's really good for me is because I live in a country with a single payer healthcare system. So
that sounds wonderful. Rather than be honest, I'll be honest with you. That sounds great.
And a lot of the things that people say about those systems isn't really true here in Austria. So, but what it does is it enables me to work as a freelancer and actually make a living without, you know, having to worry about, well, for example, my little girl, she was jumping on the trampoline and she fell and she hurt her leg. And, you know, she was taken to the hospital by an ambulance, you know.
Oh gosh. Yeah. That I'm having like panic attacks from that, just thinking about that situation here.
Yeah. Fortunately, it wasn't serious. She needed to go to the doctor, but it wasn't serious. And, you know, she got a cast and stuff like that. If I had been a freelancer and the only breadwinner in my family, I'm not the only breadwinner, but if I had been a freelancer and the only breadwinner in my family in living in, for example, Seattle, right. I don't know where those thousands of dollars would have come from. Right. So, right. But it cost me nothing. So,
yeah, I mean, I've been in the situation where, with people begging not to call the ambulance when they absolutely needed it, because doing so would be financially ruinous over here in my state of Kentucky. So understand, when you mentioned the ambulance thing very specifically, I've had very vivid flashbacks of terrible situations involving exactly that scenario.
Yeah. And I feel bad about it, but one of the reasons that it's good to be a freelancer here is that it would be a lot harder to be a freelancer in America because of the healthcare situation and the health insurance situation that is not the same here. So
if our fans who very much appreciate your work would want to follow you and learn more about what you're doing, where can they do so?
The best place to follow me is probably on Twitter. It's at Chris S. Sims. Mm-hmm. That's where I say the most, I guess. Every once in a while I post to Facebook, but for the most part I post things to Twitter. If it gets good traction on Twitter, sometimes I transcribe it to Facebook, for example. But because I think that these rules might have been
this was a Facebook post that I found them on. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that it might have been a series of tweets before I posted it to Facebook, but I don't remember anymore.
It looks like it might have been a series of tweets, but I can't verify it. And I have journalistic integrity to uphold here. Speaking of journalistic integrity, are there any projects or things you want to shout out to or draw attention to before we give this a close?
Well, I made a little game with my daughters about a year ago called Draculola, and that's available on DriveThruRPG and itch.io. It's a very simple tabletop role-playing game for kids. Mm. And if anybody's interested in something like that, they can check it out, where you pretend to be kid monsters who are making their world a better place.
Aw, that sounds wonderful. All right, Chris, thank you. Oh, sorry.
And the reason I say I made it with my daughters is because my daughters, especially my older daughter, she is the one who made up a lot of the fiction of that game, So she made up the character that we based the game on and stuff like that. And so, of course, I, as the game designer, I made the game, but a lot of the fiction is by my two preteen daughters.
Do they have like writing credits and everything?
Yeah. and
excellent,
and a very and a decent paycheck from it. So, better paycheck than I got, actually. But that was kind of the point. That was kind of the point.
Fantastic. All right, because you said that's available on DriveThru and Itch.io, right?
Right. Right.
I keep forgetting that itch.io is a fantastic place to look for some indie gems not just the video game space.
Well, I mean, if you want for Draculola, the only way to get a print version is through DriveThru. But if you just want the PDF, you can get it through either itch or DriveThru. So, but if you want the print book, then you're better to get it through DriveThru because you'll get the PDF with the print book. So.
Ooh. All right, everyone. Thank you again, Chris. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. If you want to hear more Pathfinder, Starfinder, and general geekery content, you can do so over at nodirectionpodcast.com. We'll be happy to chat with you there. And we would, of course, always like to thank our patrons who make this interview and all of our other expanded content possible. We couldn't do what we do without you. Thank you so much. If you wish to support us, do so at patreon.com/nodirection or click on the Patreon link at nodirectionpodcast.com. Until next time, I'm Jefferson J. Thacker, also known as Param, and I'm joined by Chris Sims.
Hi, everyone. Thanks.
And if you want to find the path, you need no direction.